by Simon Feynman diagrams. So the same is true for QED, and the derivation is the same. It repeats step by step the derivation for the 5-4 theory. So the only difference is in the structure of propagators and vertices, because the fields are now vector and spinner. So I remind you that the Lagrangian of QED contains the Maxwell term. Then the Dirac Lagrangian. And finally, the interaction term. So that we will treat as the interaction part of the Lagrangian. So we can quantize these terms. They don't interact independently. So they describe free particles. And then we can add, so go into the interaction representation associated with this free is the free part of the Lagrangian here, then go into the interaction picture, and then expand in the interactions. Yes?
I used the end of the second term.
Thank you. So the ingredients of perturbation theory then are the propagators of the photon and the electron, and the interaction vertex. So let's start with propagators. So for photons, everything is very simple. So the propagator of photons is the same as for the Klein-Gordon field, because we quantize photons as Klein-Gordon particles, simply adding four extra indices to them, which are vector indices. So this will be equal to minus g mu nu g of x. So this is because we treat each component of the vector potential as an independent Klein-Gordon field. With zero mass, yes. So this is zero mass Klein-Gordon fields. So we can write explicitly the momentum representation at d mu nu is equal. Also, this is if we represent it as a Fourier integral, then the propagator will be equal to minus ij mu nu p squared without the mass, and then there is the usual epsilon prescription. Yeah, so this is the photon propagator. Typically, it is depicted with a wavy line. So each end is characterized by position in space and an index. Or in the momentum representation, that there is some momentum flowing along the line. Now for fermions, the situation is a little bit different, because the fermion field anti-commutes, and that has to be taken into account when formulating the Feynman rules. So a Feynman propagator is defined more or less as usual. So it will depend on well, two positions, and also we'll have two spinner indices. So we define it as a T product, so the Green's function of the free electron field psi bar beta of y, and then averaged over the empty state. But now it's important to realize that the natural definition of the time ordering for fermions should take into account their anti-commutation. So time ordered product of psi alpha of x psi beta of y is defined in such a way that it's equal psi to psi alpha psi bar beta if the time positions of where these operators are inserted are ordered in such a way that x0 is larger than y0. And in the opposite case, we should interchange the two operators, but also add a sign, because when we interchange two fermion fields, they anti-commute. So this is a particular means that once we compute, so when we, yes?
You know, like for this propagator, how do you know to just put the metric in front of the regular propagator and then?
So I need to fix the gauge, so I impose the gauge condition. Mu is equal to zero. Then if I use this condition in the Lagrangian, this becomes simply the sum of let's say, so it becomes minus 1 half e mu a nu e mu a nu, which is a sum of four free Klein-Gordon Lagrangians, each for index, apart from the sign. So the sign is such that, so there is a minus here. Yeah. It's a wrong sign. Yes?
In your time ordering condition, in the second option, when y0 is greater than x0, option, you still have psi beta of y.
Yes, I'm sorry, yes. This should be a bit of y, and this is alpha. Just to change your papers. So this actually means that psi alpha, psi bar beta, if we compute the weak contractions in some operator expression, then if we need to interchange the position of these operators, you have to change sign. Now the same true is for normal ordering. Normal ordering for fermions also takes into account sign. So whenever you do calculations with fermions, it is important to keep track of signs. So when you interchange them, the operators, the fermion operators, the sign of the whole expression changes. Okay, then how to compute this this correlation function, the propagator, one can show that it satisfies the, well, it must satisfy something like the Dirac equation. Because the quantum field satisfies the Dirac equation. But there will be a Schwinger term. If one carefully computes it, then turns out to be proportional to delta of x and to the unit matrix. So this is a matrix equation. So this gamma matrices here have indices. and S by itself is a matrix in the spinor space. Now, Fourier transforming this, we get an algebraic equation for the Fourier image of the propagator. And so the Fourier image is just an inverse of this matrix. Right, but it is more convenient to, so it's convenient to, so one can easily invert this matrix because we know that if we multiply it with P plus M, P slash plus M, this will give P squared minus M squared. So this was the first equation that we wrote for the Dirac, in the Dirac theory. So it starts with this equation, right? So it, which means, in particular, that P minus M minus 1 is equal to P plus M divided by P squared minus M squared. So finally, we can write for the Dirac propagator. That it is given by the Fourier representation. And then there will be some denominator that contains Dirac matrices. And the usual, some numerator that contains Dirac matrices. And the usual denominator is P squared minus M squared. Now, since the Dirac propagator has indices and it connects psi with psi bar, it is important to somehow distinguish it, its endpoints. So it naturally has a direction. So therefore, one typically represents it with a line that has an arrow. So, by convention, the arrow goes from the point where we insert psi bar to the point where we insert psi. So this would depict, this would correspond to S alpha beta of x minus y, which is the contraction of f of psi alpha of x with psi bar of y. So I actually get the direction of the arrow wrong in the notes. So it's opposite. It goes from the psi bar to psi. So that this arrow is important here because it shows the flow of charge from, say, this is creation type operator for electrons, and this is annihilation, and opposite for positrons. So if this arrow denotes the creation of an electron, then it is created here, propagates along this line to point x. In the opposite case, it is a positron that is created here, and it propagates against the flow of charge, because positrons have the opposite charge to electrons, and is annihilated at this point. Also, many times in Feynman diagrams for scalars and for photons, we do not need to care what is the direction of momentum. So if we do the momentum space Feynman rules, It doesn't matter what direction the momentum flows, because the propagator depends on the p squared. Now the propagator of the fermion is on p, so there is a linear term in p. So it's very important to keep track of the momentum, because then the sign here depends on in which direction the momentum flows. So in particular, this propagator assumes that the momentum flows like that, right? So there is, or okay. So then finally, so this will contain the factor of e to the minus epx minus y. We'll have a factor of e to the minus ipx here, which corresponds to p inflowing to the vertex, and e to the ipx is a plus ipy that corresponds to momentum outflowing of the vertex. So the momentum goes along the line. So then the formula for the Green's functions and for the amplitudes are absolutely the same. So there is this master formula with the two-ordered exponential. They don't change. So the interaction vertices are determined by this term in Lagrange. And let's see what happens if we compute some particular diagram inserting this interaction Lagrangian. So suppose that we compute, say, a two-point function of psi and psi bar, and then we insert vertices. So what we insert is psi bar A psi. So that, suppose that this is inserted at point Y. Then we have a vertex psi z psi, and then psi bar of W. So this would be one of the possible corrections to the two-point function, and then we can one of the possible weak contractions is when we contract the operators just in the order that they're written. Okay, so that would give us the expression that contains three propagators. Right? Now, I deliberately don't write indices here, because indices are contracted in the way that as indicated by matrix multiplication here. So here we multiply the indices, so psi has an index, so it contracts with one index of gamma, then the next index contracts with the other psi. And so here the same happens. So the indices, the propagators, and gamma matrices in the vertices are multiplied as matrices. So this is proportional to some combination of gamma matrices. This is gamma mu contracted with A. So we just multiply them as matrices. Now, how do we depict this as a diagram? Well, there is just, so we start with from right to left. So the rightmost point will be W. Then there will be a propagator. So the direction of the arrow is opposite to the so it goes from psi bar to psi. So the arrow will go from W to Z, and then from Z to Y. And from Y to X. Okay, and then from each, so we didn't do anything with the gauge potentials, with the electromagnetic potentials, and so they will be contracted with some other, possibly other insertions of gauge potentials. So there will be photon lines going out of the points Z and Y. So important point here is that, first of all, when we do the compactions, we can forget about spinner indices because they're always multiplied along the Fermion line. So the interaction vertex is such and the propagator is such that the indices always combined into the usual matrix multiplication. Now, the order in which they are multiplied is opposite to the order of the charge flow. So we start from the end of the line, right? So here in the algebraic expression for the diagram, we start from X. So the matrices are multiplied from X and then going down up to Y. And this is opposite to the charge flow in the along the Fermion line. So the idea is that you always start from the end of the Fermion line and then go backwards and multiply all possible factors. Now, the Fermion line cannot break, right? So because of the charge conservation, each Fermion line either ends on the external fields that if you compute the Green's function of some Fermion fields, of course, there will be external lines ending and beginning at psi bar, or the Fermion line can form a closed loop. Yes.
Where do they end on? Like, what points do they propagate between?
Who?
So these? Yeah, they look like external lines, but they don't end on anything. The photon lines, I think you call them.
So here we just averaged over psi. So, well, okay. If you compute the expectation value of a new, say, R A lambda of Q or S, then we can contract, say, this A is that A, this A is that A, and so we will end on some on points, so this Z will connect with S, and Y will connect with R. Okay. Yes?
Sorry, but that's not really a two-point function. That's more a four-point function, right?
This becomes a four-point function. Yes. So
but if you had for two-point functions, you could have contracted the A and A bar, which was the two A's that were already there, and have a loop, right?
Yes, that's true, absolutely. So, in principle, one could have contracted these two guys with themselves.
So that would correspond to this diagram. So this would have corresponded to psi bar A psi bar A psi bar. So psi is contracted along the line, and then there is a contraction between S. So that would give this diagram.
Can you have a diagram like the one that you drew without the R and S points?
Yes, this is the one. It's clear from these examples that the Feynman rules contain, basically three elements. There is a propagator, so there's Feynman rules in momentum space. We'll have three basic elements. There will be a propagator. For electrons, so that is given by I e plus m e squared minus m squared. The propagator for photons. Divided by this curve. And the interaction is described by a single vertex, so that there is only one type of vertices, which describes emission of a photon from an electron by an electron and a positron, and also creation of electron-positron pairs by a photon, or annihilation of electrons and positrons into the photon. So it describes several physically different processes, but they are depicted by the same interaction vertex. And this is just given by minus I e gamma. So if this the index on the photon line is mu, then it is the same as the index of the gamma mu. Because you see that in the Lagrangian, A mu is contracted as the gamma mu.
Sorry, I'm just trying to get some things straight about this Lagrangian. So the psi here is a spinner field, right? And
yes.
Then you have A, which gives rise to the photons. But are the F mu nu's are like the kinetic term for the photons?
Yes, the F mu is the kinetic term for the photons.
And A is a vector field, so vector fields give rise to spin 1 particles here?
Yes. So if it's a spin 1 particle, it carries a vector index. It carries a vector index. So the propagator has vector indices. If you want to consider, so this is enough to compute the Green's function. Now, if you want to consider amplitudes, we need to figure out how the quantum fields contract with oscillators with which we create external states. And this is a rather boring and long exercise because we need to take the field operator, expand it in the modes, and commute it with various possible oscillators that create external states. So external states can contain positrons in spin-up, spin-down state, electrons in spin-up, spin-down state, photons in helicity plus one, minus states. And so the external lines will carry all this information. So they will have some spin index and to them attached. And so one has to just commute the field with oscillators. That would give the external line factors. But the answer is more or less obvious, because the external line factors are just the wave functions of the one particle states. So I'll just list them. So for the incoming photon, so the incoming photon should end inside the diagram on some vertex. We assign the polarization vector. So if the photon has helicity r, so we and momentum k, then we should assign the polarization vector epsilon mu of k that has helicity r. Outgoing photon with momentum k and r, and helicity r corresponds to the factor that is complex conjugate to that. So then, for incoming electron, so incoming electron has the, so the charge flows inside the diagram, right? So the arrow denotes the charge flow such that the incoming electron line has the charge flowing inside the diagram, and the factor that corresponds to it is just the wave function of the electron in the spin state S. So if it has momentum P and spin S, then we should assign US of P to this line. An outgoing electron for the outgoing electron, we have the Dirac conjugate wave function. Then for the incoming positron, the direction of the arrow should be opposite, so that the charge flows outside of the diagram. And the wave function is V bar S of P. And finally, outgoing positron corresponds to the wave function v. So notice that for electrons and positrons, the directions of the arrows are different. So the incoming electron corresponds to arrow going inside the diagram, and incoming positron has arrow going outside. This is because they have opposite charge. However, the spinners that we assign to the external lines are correlated with the direction of the arrow in the right way. So outgoing arrow is always associated with the Dirac conjugate spinner, and this is quite natural from the point of view of constructing the diagrams, because when we start to write down the expression for a diagram, we should start with the end of the line. And so at the end of the line, we have a conjugate spinner. So the expression will be u bar, and then times something that we multiplied from the inside of the diagram. And it may end, for instance, in the incoming electron line, which has u. So we have naturally the expression that is u bar, then some product of propagators and Dirac matrices, and then times u. Yes? Yes, they look the same, so they are depicted by in the same way. But you have to specify, you have to tell that this is outgoing electron and this is the incoming
positron. So that's next to information. So in particular, one and the same diagram will describe. So there's some
symmetry associated to that. We can describe outgoing the process with the outgoing electron is by this. So suppose we compute some complicated scattering amplitude with an outgoing, we say outgoing electron, right? But then the process where this outgoing electron is replaced by incoming positron will have absolutely the same amplitude. So there's some curious relationship between amplitudes of different processes. We'll return to this maybe tomorrow. Yes? Yes. So that's, you can put it that way. Sorry? Let me do it just in one case, not to lose time. So I don't know. Let's pick this line. So how do we? How should we think of this? Well, we need to compute the compression of the electron field psi out of x with the final, with the electron in the initial state, right? In S, and this will be in N. So this will be equal to the commutator of the positive frequency part of the electron field
. So the reason you're computing that contraction is because the psi field contains an annihilation operator.
Yes. The psi field contains annihilation operators. And then there will be, the final state is created by operator attribute for not at them. Created by the operator B. Which has index S. The electron creation operators were denoted by A. With momentum K. Right? Compute this commutator. So we need to write down how the electron operator looks like in terms of creation and annihilation operators. So then psi alpha of x is equal to integral that should be an anti-commutator. Thank you. So this should be let's write it as a three-dimensional integral, and then it will have here it will have the sum over spins, ASE times the spin or wave function of the electron. So this is the solution of the Dirac equation. Then plus A S bar B S dagger V S of P E to the minus 2 plus I P X. Curly brackets is the anti-commutator, so it's psi A plus. So the part of the field that contains annihilation operators, we denote by psi plus, and this part by psi minus. So we need to anti-commute psi plus with A. So we should take this part of the field, then there will be sum over, let me change this summation index to R, U R alpha, E to the minus IPX, and then there will be an anti-commutator of A R P with A S dagger K. Okay? So this anti-commutator is equal to this is canonical anti-commutation, canonical anti-commutator of creation and inflation operators. It's equal to 2 pi cubed delta R S delta of P minus K. So the delta function removes integration over momentum. So the Kronecker delta removes summation over the spins.
And so finally we get that this is equal to U S alpha of P of K, because so this has an argument P, but then P becomes equal to K because of the delta function, and e to the minus IPX. So this exponential factor is removed by the Fourier transform, so in Fourier space Feynman rules it's absent. Sorry, this is minus kx. And so what we are left with is just the wave function, the solution of the Dirac equation. So all other cases can be analyzed similarly. And it's if you do all of these calculations one by one, it's quite a long exercise. Any other questions about this Feynman rules?
Yes. This is going back a long way, but earlier on when you had, like many lectures ago, the Klein-Gordon field, you had the creation annihilation operators were given by A and A star. So these two separate,
yes,
so the A and B, these have to do with positive and negative
charge. Yes, so,
this
operator creates positrons. So the field can annihilate electrons and create positrons. And therefore, this is the reason why these two lines are saved. Right? The conjugate field, or actually this corresponds to that line and to that line. The conjugate field, side bar, will contain the annihilation operators of electrons, annihilation operators of positrons. So that will correspond to the other cases.
So if you just naively selected, you didn't know if you were going to get positrons and electrons out of your theory, and you just set it up with, say, two A's, what would you be able to create a self-consistent theory or not?
It will not be self-consistent because the Dirac field as we constructed it was a complex operator. So it was not a Hermitian operator. So if that term would be contained A, this would be just a one would be complex conjugate. Hermitian conjugate to another, and then phi would have been Hermitian field. Now, to construct the theory of Hermitian electron fields, one has to do certain things differently. So I'll not go into details, but anyway, it's a different theory. The spinner should be the component, etc. So now, with this Feynman rules, we can compute, potentially we can compute any amplitude in QED. And we'll study, so that the next goal will be to study some simplest QED processes of scattering between electrons and positrons. The simplest, positrons and electrons and photons are stable particles. They cannot decay into anything. So the simplest processes are 2-2, which means scattering. In fact, this process is elementary process in quantum electrodynamics, so the leading order perturbation theory were studied before Feynman rules, before the theory was created, by means of old-fashioned quantum mechanical perturbation theory. These were really, really huge calculations. So some diamond authorities that were done by classics of quantum theory. And Feynman rules just streamline them and make them to do them easily and without much effort. Moreover, Feynman rules allow one to take into account corrections for this. One can increase accuracy and compute for higher orders perturbation theory. So we will not do that, but we'll study just the simplest leading order UD processes. And to begin with, I would like to reproduce something that we know very well, namely the Coulomb potential. So
just the static interaction between electrons among the electrons. So the idea will be to study to calculate the amplitude of electron-electron scattering in QED, and then consider it in the non-relativistic limit. So when electrons, incoming electrons, have very, very small momentum, and then we can compare it to the Born amplitude in quantum mechanics, which is given by basically by the Fourier transform of the potential. So that's why the Fourier transform of the amplitude, the inverse Fourier transform of the amplitude, will give the potential, which certainly should be the Coulomb one. So so let's study the process of scattering of an electron with momentum p and spin s on the electron with the momentum k and spin r, and suppose that they go into the electron with momentum p prime and spin s prime, and electron with momentum k prime and spin r prime. In QED this is called bubble scattering. Because the first honest calculation of this amplitude was done by Babu in 35, yes. So before quantum electrodynamics, so he did it using usual quantum mechanical perturbation theory, which is quite amazing because the answer is not very simple. And it is a difficult calculation. In quantum field theory, computing the amplitude is relatively easy. Then going from the amplitude to cross section, again, is somewhat more complicated. Now, in the diagram language, there are two possible diagrams that we can draw. Right, so we start with the electron with two electrons. And of course, so the electrons can disappear, so this electron can become either that electron or that electron in the final state. And then in between, they may exchange a photon. So there are two diagrams. Then there is another diagram where the electron lines cross. So then we should apply Feynman rules to these diagrams and compute the analytic expressions that correspond to these amplitudes. So let's start with this diagram. So we want to compute this reduced matrix element. And to that, so this is the matrix element of the T operator without the momentum conserving delta function. So let's see. Then we multiply all elements along the Fermion propagator, starting with the ends. And so here, and then here we only have external Fermion lines. And the vertex is just the gamma matrix, right? So that line corresponds to U bar. Oh, first of all, there is the coupling constant here, right? So the each vertex comes with a factor of minus IE. Then there will be U bar S prime of P prime, gamma mu, U S of P. So this is momentum, and this is spin. So spin can be either plus 1/2 or minus 1/2. Oh, that's just a, yeah.
This is not relevant for the physics, but that's known as a Möller scan.
Möller scan. Yeah, electron Möller scattering. No, Möller. Are you sure? I think bubble scattering is electron.
Or Mendelssohn is wrong. As I say, it's not important. But just.
But the name sticks. So
yeah.
It's important to know the knowledge. Does anyone have this answer?
We have Wikipedia.
All right.
Okay, so this is called Möller scattering. Fine. So okay, then what do we have? So for the second line, we have U bar R prime of K prime, then the gamma matrix, and then U R K. And then we should multiply this by the photon propagator, minus I G mu, divided by P minus P prime squared. And so if this momentum is P, right? This momentum is P prime. So the momentum that flows through the photon propagator is P minus P prime. And then there is the second diagram. But now in the second diagram, it's clear that it will give the same answer with the two particles in the final state interchanged. But since these particles are fermions, we need also to change the sign. So it will be given by the minus the second diagram with P prime R prime interchanged with k prime r p prime s prime interchange this k prime r prime. Now to make contact with this non-relativistic theory, we need to take a non-relativistic limit of this amplitude. And so in the non-relativistic limit, the spinner wave function is given by this expression, so its lower and upper components are the same. And then, okay, so we should compute this matrix elements of the gamma matrices. And also we can assume that let's see. So you see, this is independent of momentum, right? So we can forget about the argument of the wave function. So this will be u of s prime, and then let's compute. Let's compute the matrix element of gamma zero, right? So, so the Dirac conjugate is the same as the Hermitian conjugate multiplied by gamma zero. Gamma zero squared is one, so this will be equal to U.S. dagger times U U.S. prime, which is equal to 2m delta SS prime. Now u bar s gamma I u s prime, and here we will need to use the explicit form of the Dirac matrices, so this will be equal to Cs dagger Cs dagger, then gamma zero, then we'll have the gamma I matrix, and so I claim that this is equal to zero. So you see, this is equal to m. Then psi s dagger psi s dagger zero minus sigma I plus sigma I minus sigma I zero psi s with the primes, which is m psi I multiply first this with that. Okay. If you wish, you can first multiply these matrices, then it's probably even more obvious. Anyway, so this or that way, but this is zero. So in the non-relativistic approximation, this matrix elements has a very simple form. only zeros component survives. And so for the amplitude, we only need the zeros, so the zero, zero component of the propagator in that limit. So so also we can simplify the denominator. Our denominator will be equal to the energy of electron of the initial, the difference of the energies squared minus the difference of momenta squared. And so in the non-relativistic approximation, the energy is, well, mass of the electron plus its kinetic energy. So masses cancel here. And this term is actually of order of pi to the 4 divided by m squared. So it is suppressed by the square of the electron mass. We consider the situation where the momenta are small compared to the mass. And so the denominator is basically the square of the momentum transfer. Now let's take to make life simpler, let's say that S is equal to S prime and R is equal to R prime. And also, S is not equal to R. So then, because, so you see that the spins of initial and final particles should be the same because of this Kronecker delta. In that case, the second diagram will be equal to zero. So because the spins don't match. And then the amplitude will be equal to what? To will be equal to minus e squared from here. Then two m squared from the normalization of the spinor wave function. And then, let's see. Then G zero zero with the minus divided by minus the momentum transfer squared, right? So G zero zero is one, so we find that the amplitude is negative. Now this we need to compare with the non-relativistic Born amplitude. So in quantum mechanics, the leading order scattering amplitude in the of potential scattering is equal to minus the Fourier transform of the potential. So in particular, the amplitude is negative for the repulsive potential. So you see that here we have minus sign, so the potential indeed comes out repulsive. Then this factor should be dropped when comparing to non-relativistic theory, because we normalize with functions differently. So this assumes that the wave function is normalized to 1. And this assumes that the wave functions are normalized to M. So the factor of 2M squared takes into account the difference. And finally, we see that what stands here is the Fourier transform of the potential. So to get the potential in the coordinate space, we need to transform back. So V of x will be equal to the Fourier transform IQX E squared over Q squared, which is equal to E squared over 4 pi absolute value of X, which is the repulsive Coulomb potential. Which this
integral like dimensional counting, it should be should scale as 1/x. To get this 4 pi, well, certainly one can do this integral. One can say change variables to the x coordinates along the vector x, choose x to be along the x-axis, then integrate over the two perpendicular coordinates, and then you get some integral that gives you 1 over 5 x. So here is how Coulomb potential arises in field theory. Yes.
If you had included the second Feynman diagram by changing what? Saying S equals R.
Yes, so that would correspond to the exchange interaction. So if you have let's see. If you have identical particles. If you study identical particles, then, of course, the amplitude should be symmetrized. So the reference wave function should be symmetrized due to the statistics. And so the amplitude has two terms, because the initial particle can become one or the other. So because of the anti-symmetry of the wave function. So therefore, the Born amplitude also would have two terms, different by sign. So with the same as in non-relativistic quantum mechanics. Now, if one would consider scattering of
electron on a positron is explained as a bubble scattering, then what we will get is a minus sign here.
What we should get is the is an extra sign that changes repulsion to attraction. So then that can be traced to in the Feynman diagram language that corresponds to some little sign that arises when we interchange, when we do weak contractions, because we would need to pass two operators, two Feynman operators through one another. I probably have no time to talk about that, but if one considers interactions mediated by scalars, so these interactions are called Yukawa interactions. So if interacting Lagrangian is equal to minus G phi psi bar psi, so this is the simplest interaction between electrons and some scalar particle, then the interaction is universally will be universally attractive. So the reason why the electromagnetic interactions can be either attractive or repulsive in this field theory language follows from the fact that in the propagator we have G mu with the minus sign. So this minus sign leads eventually to repulsion in the electron-electron channel. So there will be no such sign. So if this propagator were scalar, we would have lost one minus, and the interaction would have been attractive. So this is actually a general feature. So exchange of particles of even spin leads always to attraction, and particles of odd spin can lead to either repulsion or attraction. So the famous example of this is gravity. So graviton has spin 2. And therefore, gravity is universally attractive force. Also, to some extent, one can explain the nature of nuclear forces by that. So in a very, very crude sense, nuclear forces are described by this Yukawa interaction. And so since the Yukawa interaction is attractive, nuclear forces are universally attractive. Therefore, nuclei can bind, nucleons can bind together to form nuclei, despite their the fact that protons repel each other electromagnetically. And also, scalar fields naturally have masses, so it's impossible to add mass term to the electromagnetic field without violating gauge symmetry. But to the Klein-Gordon field, one can easily add a mass, and because of the mass, the potentials, the interaction potential come out short range, so it will be cut off at the scales of the Compton wavelengths of this mediator of the force. And so this in some sense explains why nuclear forces are so short-ranged. I'll stop here. That's it for today. Thank you.